Good afternoon. The time is 2 o'clock. Welcome to Vox Pop for this Thursday, March 23rd. I'm Ray Graff. It's Astronomy Today. Today we welcome back Bob Berman and Valerie Rapson to talk about astronomy, which is a good idea, and to take your questions. So if you have a question about the heavens, give us a call. 800-348-2551. Turns out that interstellar object that some scientists thought might be an intergalactic spacecraft, turned out it was just a little gassy. We'll talk about that. The Webb Telescope took some neat pictures of a star just about ready to go supernova. Plenty to talk about. Volcanoes on Venus. 800-348-2551 if you want to join the conversation. Or you can email voxpop@wamc.org. Valerie and Bob and your questions coming up. Hello again, friends. Let's talk astronomy today on Vox Pop. I'm Ray Graff. Two astronomers in the studio today to answer your questions about the final frontier. Bob Berman is here. You know Bob. He's the astronomy editor for the Old Farmer's Almanac and a contributing editor at Astronomy Magazine. Dr. Valerie Rapson is assistant professor of physics and astronomy at SUNY Oneonta, and she earned her PhD in astrophysical science and technology at RIT. If you have a question about space, the final frontier, give us a call. 800-348-2551, 800-348-2551, or email voxpop@wamc.org. That's voxpop@wamc.org, or email, no, or phone 800-348-2551. That's what I'm talking about. Bob Berman, it's been a while. How are you?
Oh, great, great, great. It's great to be back.
Indeed it is. It's great to have you back, and you were all over the place, yeah?
Yeah, vacation in the Andaman Sea on five different islands, and that was, I would have said great, except it was so hot and humid, I was actually glad to leave that. And then my annual Aurora tour up in Alaska, and what a nice group of 45 smart, interesting, upbeat people.
Really?
Yeah, and
Is upbeat a key thing for this? Can you be dour and go?
Well, it's more fun to be around upbeat people. Right?
I suppose.
And we saw two auroras, which may have helped make them upbeat.
Oh, that's cool. That's great.
Yeah.
Hey, Valerie Rapson, how are things going over at Oneonta?
Oh, they're going great. Last week was spring break, so now we're all refreshed and ready to finish the semester.
That's why you look so relaxed right now.
Right. Wow. It's officially spring. We've had break. We're good to go.
By the way, I just saw a tweet. I don't know from where it came, but apparently a big possibility of some super northern lights tomorrow night.
Did
you see that?
I did see that. It looks like the sun has opened up a hole, spit a bunch of solar wind our way, and it should hit us sometime tomorrow. So tomorrow evening should be good for looking for aurora.
Just about the time the clouds roll in.
I know.
That's the way it works.
Yeah.
I also saw, and this we didn't talk about this prior to the show, but I saw a news item that five planets will be in a row this coming either today or soon.
Yeah, when you think about it, sure. But a little bit less of a dramatic row that we sometimes get because it's broken up into the morning sky and then the evening sky. So you'd have to dedicate yourself to both getting up before dawn and watching after sunset.
All right, fair enough. Well, Valerie, you sent some great topics today. And let's first head to Venus,
sure,
where they found some 30-year-old signs of volcanoes. Why is that important?
Well, we've been studying Venus for a long time. These are actually images from the Magellan spacecraft in the early 90s. And it looked like Venus was volcanically active. It's very smooth, very few craters on the surface. But we didn't see any, you know, active erupting volcanoes, or so we thought in the data that we had. But it turns out one of the scientists was going back and looking at this old data, flipping through and comparing images, and comparing the same spot over a few months or years' time, he saw a volcanic vent that apparently opened up, and you can see the lava flow and extend in the before and after pictures. So it turns out that Venus really is volcanically active.
One of the things in the article that you sent, I think it was from Sky and Telescope, that the surface of Venus is geologically young, maybe only tens of millions of years old. Right. How can that be? It's been around as long as we have, right?
Right, right. Well, the planet itself is 4.5 billion years
right.
old. But when we talk about the surface, we can have a lot of resurfacing from erosion of wind and water, from volcanic eruptions, things like that. So because Venus was volcanically active, or really we should say now is volcanically active, all of those lava flows are filling in the craters and bringing the molten crust up to the surface and changing the surface. So we say it's geologically young on top, even though the whole planet is the same age as the solar system.
It's Astronomy Today with Valerie Rapson at Bob Berman. The number is 800-348-2551. The email address is voxpop@wamc.org. Oumuamua. That's how you say it, right? Mm-hmm. That's that object that came in from outside of our solar system, hauling toward the sun and then out again. And there was a time, and I think there were still some scientists, I think there's a Harvard professor who still says, hey, this could be an alien spacecraft.
Because it's sped up.
Right. Mm-hmm. Bob Berman for 3 points on that, indeed. There was a lot of speculation, but now there was another article, I think, also in Sky and Telescope, where they said, no, wasn't aliens after all.
Right. Well, as Bob said, you know, this thing sped up as it looped around the sun, which made us think, oh, maybe some aliens turned on engines or something like that. But what this article says is this object came from very far from the sun, and out beyond the edge of the solar system, it gets hit by a lot of cosmic rays. Very energetic. They can break up frozen water. So now you've got H2 and O frozen separately on this comet or this object. And when it comes near the sun and heats up, that hydrogen is going to evaporate. And if it gets pushed off the comet, it's going to just aim it forward and cause it to accelerate. So the modeling and the pictures that they have looked at suggest that that was the case. It wasn't actually, you know, alien rocket engines. It was just outgassing of hydrogen.
As far as we know.
As far as we can tell.
And then the other one, and all I could print was a black and white version of this, but the color might be false color. The color pictures of this rare sight of this, what they call a Wolf-Rayet star, very interesting. Tell us about that.
They're so pretty. It's like this big pink and purple image. These are basically old stars that are, they're massive stars that are relatively old in their life cycle. So we're talking millions of years old. And they're getting ready to go supernova. They've puffed up. They're so big that they're starting to lose material. This one in particular, I think, was like 30 solar masses, and it's already lost like 10 of it to space, which is crazy. So we're seeing what looks like a supernova remnant around a star that hasn't actually gone supernova yet.
So cool. Bob Berman, why, and you did a great book on the sun, and so I'll throw this to you. Why are supermassive stars, why is their lifespan so much shorter?
Oh, because the pressure on their core is greater because they have the greater mass, meaning the greater gravity pushing on the core, and that means the core is going to be more active. Now, our sun loses between 4 and 6 million tons of itself every second, which is amazing. It means if you could weigh the sun on some kind of giant scale, it actually weighs up to 6 million tons less every single second, and that's its core converting mass into all that nice light and heat that we've grown accustomed to, at least we will once spring really gets going here. But on a heavier star, the fusion core is more active, so it uses up more material faster. That makes it hotter. Everything follows from the mass. From the mass, you get higher rate of activity, which means higher temperature, which means a temperature that's more, well, we'd call it cool, which is funny when you buy a light and then it's 5,000 K instead of 2,500 K. We say it's a cooler light, but it's really a much hotter temperature that produces that. And greater luminosity, and we're talking about much greater luminosity. So all of these things go together, color, temperature, luminosity, brightness, and age, because even though paradoxically it started out with a lot more mass, that's why this is happening, it's using up its mass faster, so it never lives to be old. Mm-hmm.
Astronomy Today with Valerie Rapson and Bob Berman. The number is 800-348-2551. We'll do one email here, then we'll take a break, and then we'll hit the phones. The email address is voxpop@wamc.org. This is from Paladin in the Adirondack Park. And the subject heading is occultation. Occultation is how you say it? It's an eclipse, right? April 8th, 2024. That's the biggie. Can you recommend concise reading and other preparation for that event on April 8th, 2024?
Well, Bob, I think you've got some books and some great reading material for that, don't you?
Yes, but that's the big one. You know, we don't get that many eclipses. I mean, the big thing that happens on that date is the total eclipse of the sun with a path that is very favorable. Starts up in southern Texas near Austin and then heads north by northeast. It's total over Cleveland, total over Buffalo, total over Syracuse, even the southernmost Montreal.
And, Plattsburgh, Montpelier, Burlington.
Burlington. I mean, you could drive there from our listening area here in just a few hours, and that doesn't happen very often. So, and when we get closer to it, we'll be repeating ourselves until we're hoarse to say, do not go by all the news articles saying that if you live, let's say, in the Bronx, you're within the path of the eclipse, because you don't want to see the eclipse. You want to see totality, because mm-hmm. totality is where every cool thing happens. Things happen that don't happen at any other time. So you need to get into the path of totality, which this time is going to be easy.
All right. Nobody has a concise bit of reading on the
Well, NASA has a nice new website. They just put out a beautiful graphic. They've kind of fine-tuned exactly where totality is going to be. So they're actively developing a website that's going to have all the pertinent information of where you should go, how you can buy the glasses that you need, and all of that type of stuff. But usually there's just a handful. If you Google, you know, eclipse websites and things like that, you should be able to find the best ones.
Now, I know it's a year away, a little more than that, but our writer says welder's glass, number 12. Is that okay?
12 is good. 13 is probably perfect.
14.
14 is a little better. There was a time when many websites were saying only 14 is safe, but we had experts at first Discover Magazine, then Astronomy Magazine, eye experts, and then more recently there's been studies done in Canada and in Australia by eye experts saying that what's safe is anything from welder shade 12 right through 14. They're all safe, 12, 13, and 14. You don't want anything lower than a 12 because that could hurt your eyes. And welders actually use 10s usually. Mm-hmm. And so you don't want to use a normal welding shade, but 12, 13, and 14. And on all of our eclipses, when we take people there and we let people try out different shades to see which they prefer, just aesthetically, because they're all safe. 12, 13, 14 are all safe. People like the lighter shades. Most people find 14s too dark, just aesthetically.
Okay.
I find 12s, frankly, a little on the bright side. Safe but bright. So I think the ideal would be 13s, but almost nobody uses them. So the trick is, find out where your local welding supply store is. It's usually in the most rundown part of town with snarling dogs behind fences and stuff. And buy yourself, because they're only about a buck and a half each, buy yourself 30 of them, 40 of them for your friends.
And for the dog.
13s if you really want the ideal thing. And so you're ready for them. And the only time you need them is when it's not totality, because there's 2 hours of eclipses of the eclipse where you have to have eye protection if you value your eyesight. And there's only going to be a few minutes where it's total, where it's safe to look at directly without eye protection. Okay. So you definitely want those filters.
Valerie, you want to add something?
Well, I was just going to say, I'm glad you said that, because I had always thought that 14 was the best one, really the only one, and it's really hard to find unless you special order it. So 12 is definitely good. And like Bob said, you should buy now. Don't wait for a month ahead. Don't wait for 2 days ahead.
Right.
Buy it today and save it, because everything's going to be gone at least 6 months out, because we have one in October, too. So people are going to start buying already.
Good plan. Let's take a break. Astronomy Today, 800-348-2551 is the number. Email voxpop@wamc.org. We'll be right back. Vox Pop on WAMC. It's Astronomy Today with Bob Berman and Valerie Rapson. 800-348-2551 is the number. Email is voxpop@wamc.org. Right before we get to the phones, I remember the last time I was witness to an eclipse, and I don't think it was a full eclipse. I made the old-fashioned. I got a box and put a hole in it, and it was actually pretty cool. Yeah. I mean, that's an elementary school project, but you really see the image of the eclipse. It's neat.
It's super cool. The leaves on the trees will do that, too. When we had the eclipse in 2017, I remember people walking underneath this tree, and I would yell at them and say, "Watch out, you're stepping on the eclipse." And they'd panic for a second, and then they'd realize that, oh, it's just the trees doing the projection.
Our number here is 800-348-2551. Let's go to the phone. Steve in Albany. Steve, you're on.
Hi, I was on the trip to see the Northern Lights with Bob Berman a few weeks ago.
Oh, Steve, that was so great to meet you and to have you on that eclipse. It was such a pleasure.
Well, thank you, and it was a pleasure to meet you. Okay. And, of course, it's a long flight home, so I had time to think of a couple of extra questions.
Oh, that's great.
I'd love to. I loved your explanation. I didn't know realize that the eclipse was because – not the eclipse, the the Northern Lights was because of the solar wind. But that sort of explains to this layman why the lights would hug the horizon, not those pictures that I've seen where it seems to be perpendicular to the horizon. So that's one question. The other question that I had is what effect, if any, is going to be the effect of global warming on the lights?
Huh? Well, so far the effect has not been one that we like in our annual Alaska trip because, as you know, extra warmth means extra moisture in the air, and Alaska has become cloudier and warmer as the years have gone by, with actually permafrost melting and visible changes. And the locals, the natives, have been telling us that they see dramatic changes in just the last 10 or 15 years. And we've seen changes in the sky. Of course, we want nothing but clear skies, and there have been fewer of them. And we think that's due to global warming. So that's the big negative effect.
But to be clear, the actual auroras themselves completely unaffected by any.
That's right, because they're way above
where weather is. And what was the first question again?
The first question was about those images of the aurora where things seem to be going on perpendicular to the horizon, which don't, the solar wind doesn't explain it to this layman.
No, and you're quite right. And that just has to do with where you're situated relative to where the lights are. If you happen to be right under a display, then what it looks like is like you're drunk waking up underneath curtains and you're looking straight up to see the bottom side of wavy curtains and you're looking at the bottom fringe. But then you can also see the folds heading up away from you, which by a trick of perspective looks like they're going off into infinity. And that's a very dramatic effect, but you only get that if you're right under an aurora. Now, the ones we saw during your trip, the two auroras, they were off, it looked like in the distance. We were looking at them, you're quite right, more face on or horizontally to them. So that's why they had that appearance.
All right, Steve, thanks a lot for the call. 800-348-2551 is our number. Dr. Valerie Rapson is with us and our friend Bob Berman as well. We'll go to Colony. Mark, you're on.
Hello. Hello. Thank you for taking my call.
You bet.
Can you hear me?
Sure. Go ahead.
I have a question that's been bothering me for quite a while, and I should know the answer, but I don't. So I figure I better call, and I think you guys could probably answer it. It's about Hubble Deep Field. I know that in the course of, you know, over the course of a week or two, you gather all this light, and you have individual galaxies that could be 15 billion years old, but you also have galaxies there that are 6 billion years old, 5 billion years old, 4 billion years old, all the way down to, you know, stars that are nearby. My question really is, if you're collecting this much light and you have a galaxy that's 15 billion years old, but 13 billion years old, why don't you also see it in the sky somewhere where it's also 10 billion years old and 8 billion years old? And it also would seem to me that they should all be like connected images of the same galaxy progressing through time. What am I missing?
Right. Well, the light is actually physically traveling to us from outer space. So when we gather it, we are seeing the light as it was, as you said, 13, 10 billion years ago, whatever the distance to the object is. But our universe is expanding. And that, I think, is the key piece, is that, you know, we have expanded and moved away from all of these objects that you're seeing in the deep field. The further away they are, the faster they're moving away from us. So it literally takes time for the light to travel to our eyes to be able to see these objects. So I think it's a combination of the universe expansion and the light travel time that's tripping you up there.
Mark.
I got the impression. I figured it was something like that. But so you're saying that it's technically, so it can't, they're not what necessarily, you don't have individual images of the same galaxy at different points of time.
Well, most of them, no. we can get into gravitational lensing and cool tricks like James Webb has a lot of cool pictures now where you see the same galaxy four times at four different ages, and that's the material in the foreground being denser and warping space-time more so that it actually takes longer for the light to travel to your eyes so you see it at different timescales, which is really, really cool.
Yeah. If I can add, no, anytime you look at something, you're seeing it as it was when the light left. You're not seeing multiple images because you couldn't. Like, if I'm looking at Ray sitting across the table at the moment for me in the studio, if he's 6 feet away, well, it takes light 6 nanoseconds to traverse that distance. So I'm not seeing him as he is. I'm seeing him as he was 6 nanoseconds or 6 billionths of a second ago. And that's the only Ray that I can see. Yeah. I can't see the current Ray, and I can't see Ray back when he went to high school. I can't see multiple rays. So you just see it anything when the light is arriving.
Right. Mark, thanks a lot for the call. So all we see then as humans is the past.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Basically. Yeah, exactly. And in the case of Hubble, what was cool there is that 100 hours of exposure with that 94-inch mirror telescope staring at a part of the sky. Now, listen to this. It was only as big, the Hubble Deep Space image taken of part of Ursa Major, just off the Big Dipper, was only the size of a grain of sand. It
wow.
took in the whole image that you saw was a grain of sand's worth of sky.
Yeah.
About 100 hours amazing. Of looking at it with that telescope. So it showed it was really a sampling mission. Like, what do you see if you can look without blinking at one little spot of the sky? And it was showing more galaxies than foreground stars.
It's Astronomy Today on Vox Pop. 800-348-2551 is the telephone number. Email is voxpop@wamc.org. We'll get to a bunch of emails in a little bit, but let's go to New Paltz. Paul, you're on.
Yes. I'm wondering, is there a black hole in the constellation Swan?
Yes.
And what exactly is a black hole?
Okay. And I'll handle that since Valerie's pointing at me. There's a star just near the star Eta Cygni that's in the neck, the star in the middle of the neck of Cygnus the Swan, and it's a star named Eta Cygni, and just a half a degree to the east, northeast of that, is a star that you'd need binoculars or a small telescope to see, a star with the name of HDE 226868, which is the typical name for a star
of that brightness. This is why I pointed at Bob. He knows all the numbers.
Yeah. And it turns out that HDE 226868 does this weird circular motion once every 6 days. Now, this is a heavy star. We know from its spectral properties that it weighs at least 8 or 10 times more than the sun. So the only thing that can move around such a heavy star, like a sumo wrestler throwing around something that weighs a little less than it, has to be something that's massive, similarly massive. So
okay.
That's hint number one. Secondly, we get blinking from that object in X-rays, mm-hmm. and that's just what theory tells us a black hole should do. And also, the rate of the blinking shows us it's a very tiny object. And so if you put all the data together, it's the surest black hole in the whole sky. You can't see it by definition. It's just black. But everything that it's doing and everything that's emitting from there, the X-rays, only a black hole makes sense.
Mm-hmm. And it's really just this tiny little spot with a ton of mass crammed into something really small. Like if you were going to take the Earth and turn it into the black hole or into a black hole, it'd have to be the size of a nickel. Like it would fit in the palm of your hand. So you just compress a whole bunch of mass into a really small space. It warps the space around it gravitationally, and it creates these really cool effects nearby.
Paul, you want to follow up?
Is it like a vacuum cleaner, so to speak, that it's pulling into itself all kinds of stuff, including light?
So I'm
a black hole pull stuff into itself.
Okay.
And there's nothing you see on the other side of the black hole or around the black hole.
Now, it's a misconception. It's a misconception that black holes pull things in. What it actually does is that light from behind it, that's trying to pass it on its way to us, can't, because the warpage of space-time is so complete that the object can't get past it, and that it bends inward. And that's one of the reasons we call it a hole. But as Valerie made clear, I hope, a moment ago, it's the opposite of a hole. A hole suggests emptiness. And this is a place where matter is so compressed that there is nothing like it. It's a degree of density and compression that we don't even see anywhere around us in space. Mm-hmm. So it's the opposite of a hole.
And Paul, I'm going to tell you the one thing that I hope my students take away from my classes when I teach them about black holes is that black holes don't suck. That's what I tell them. Black holes don't suck.
Very clever.
They're not like giant vacuums. Like,
Glenn.
Yeah. If the sun became a black hole.
So it actually can be a star that is being born.
Well, not quite. Stars can die and create black holes. However you get a bunch of material packed into a small enough space will do it. But we think that supermassive stars, their cores will collapse and create these black holes like Cygnus X-1 that we're seeing. So that's how they're created. And then material just falls in, but it has to get close enough on its own to fall into the gravitational force of the black hole. It doesn't just suck everything up in the universe.
And that's the key, what Valerie just said. If our sun should collapse to become a black hole, which it can't because it's not massive enough, but if it did in the next second, we wouldn't be affected at all. We wouldn't be pulled toward the sun because the sun's overall gravity wouldn't change. It would be the same as it is now. We'd keep orbiting it just as we did before. We wouldn't even move one inch closer to the sun as a black hole than the sun before it became a black hole. They really have a bad reputation, sort of like rats.
Rats.
Well, because of the plague and stuff. You know, those of you who have had pet rats, as I have, know that they're...
You've had pet rats.
I love rats. Rats are they're clean, they're intelligent, they bond to their owners. I had a rat sitting in my shirt pocket while I was writing one of my books.
You know
books.
What? Let's take a call. 800-348-2551 is the number. It's Astronomy Today. Bob Berman is here, sans rats, and also Dr. Valerie Rapson. Let's go to Kingsbury. Rick, you're on.
Hi, I was calling about the eclipse and looking at it.
Yeah.
I have a welding helmet that is, you know, the auto darkening. So as you strike the arc, it'll become darker with the intensity of the light. And I was just curious if that would be a functional way of looking at the eclipse.
I would not trust it because welders don't need that kind of super darkening that is safe for your eyes during an eclipse. As I say, you can use the helmet, but just change the filter in it to a 12, 13, or 14 shade, and any welding supply store will be happy to do that for you. And it's only a couple of bucks. Easy to do.
You don't think that it would have the ability to darken it as it changed?
No, not that much, because welders, actual welders don't need that degree of darkness.
Okay.
I don't think you want to risk it or gamble on that, Rick, but thank you for the call. 800-348-2551.
I just want to chime in and say that even if you do, you know, quickly look at the sun with these types of helmets and it doesn't feel like it hurts your eyes, you can't always feel the infrared and the UV that's making it through that's hurting your eyes. So you could see damage later on, even if it doesn't feel like you're hurting your eyes during the time. So better to be safe than sorry.
All right, let's go to Poughkeepsie and Yolanda. You're on.
Hello, how are you?
Good, how are you?
I'm doing well. So my question has to do with space weather, and when there's like a storm on the sun that affects the Earth, I'm wondering, is there any predictions on any major storms? I don't even know if I'm saying the right word, that could affect the Earth.
No, you are, and that's the astronomer's dream, is to be able to actually predict all of these things. So we do know that the sun goes through cycles. It's got an 11-year cycle, so we see maximums and minimums where we expect more or less activity. But we're nowhere near the point where we could say, oh, we're going to have 10 sunspots a week from now, or even to be able to look at current sunspots and say there's going to be a flare there tomorrow. That's not something we're able to do yet, but we do have the time. Once the spot releases the flare, we get a couple of days because that's the particle travel time to get to the Earth. So that kind of allows us to prepare. If something major were going to happen and we were going to get hit by a big one, we'd have a couple of days heads up.
And before, Bob, you comment, the event that is happening now or just happened on the sun, which could produce some great northern lights tomorrow and perhaps even tonight, I don't know, what exactly happened on the sun?
Well, so the sun has a corona, an atmosphere around it, and occasionally you get coronal holes where the magnetic field travels particularly far. It kind of opens up this gap and it allows more solar wind to leave.
Yep.
So these are not the flares, the coronal mass ejections that are particularly
dangerous.
This is not
dangerous. An X2 or an X1 or anything
like
that.
No, this is just the general wind. It's just a little bit more intense and it can disrupt radio communications. It might not be safe for pilots to fly over the North or South Pole in the next day or two, but it's nothing major, but we will get some cool auroras to see.
All right, Bob, quickly before our next break, you wanted to comment.
Yeah, and that is everybody, if the weather permits, tomorrow night, look to the northwest because our magnetic pole is not north of us, it's northwest of us, and that's where the auroras are generally centered. Moonlight will not interfere, that's the good news. All we need is clear weather, and any time of night, grab it. Just look out towards the north, let your eyes get dark adapted, get used to the dark, and any glow that you see, sometimes it just starts out as a patch, a glowing patch, but then it can develop arcs, shapes, all sorts of patterns that can become breathtaking. We last had one on March 13th, 1989, that was from here, and it was all night, and it was all sky, and could even be seen from Mexico.
Oh, boy.
And this has the potential to be as good tomorrow night.
Well,
so if the weather is clear, which
it won't be. Our forecast is saying mostly cloudy around here tomorrow, but you never know. We might get lucky. Let's take a break. 800-348-2551 is our number. Oh, some nice jazz. Now I do feel lucky. We'll be back. We'll hit... Astronomy Today on Vox Pop, 800-348-2551 is our telephone number. We're joined by Valerie Rapson at Bob Berman. And let's grab a few emails at voxpop@wamc.org before we head back to the phones. This one's from Mary in Wilbraham. Subject heading, time travel. How do we overcome the time dilation effect for time travel? Is it simply a matter of speed, finding fuel technology enough to overcome it? Because theoretically, isn't it true, the only limit is the speed of light. Approaching it, you can time travel, but you must break, surpass it to return. We also never thought we'd break the speed of sound, that it would cause people to explode, etc. But lo and behold, thanks, Chuck Yeager. The only effect was sonic boom. Why can't we similarly, theoretically, be able to someday break the speed of light and therefore time travel, in which case these unidentified crafts could just be us from the future? And that's Marion Wilbraham.
Well, I'm chuckling because it's so fascinating to think about. I wish I had the answer, right? Then I'd have the Nobel Prize. But it's going to be hard. And you got to remember that time dilation doesn't affect you. It affects everybody else. So you're going to experience life on that spacecraft as you normally would. It's just everybody at home is going to age so rapidly that you, like the caller said, would not be able to return and talk about your trip. So I don't have the answer. There really isn't an easy way.
Bob.
Plus, there's some paradoxes with this. On the one hand, time is an integral component of space-time, as Einstein told us. That is the matrix in which everything exists. But if you try to segregate time from space, you come across things that are non-existent. And so taken all by itself, time doesn't exist. And the past, the future, even Einstein said this, there may not be a reality to time, not to mention that there are theorists these days like Kip Thorne and John Wheeler used to say this, that say that the past is not set in stone. It's malleable. We always think of the future as not yet set. The present is still unfolding, but the past is permanent and set and unchangeable. The belief increasingly is that the past also is changeable depending upon observations at the present moment. For example, let's say we're observing a bit of light that's squirming its way around a foreground massive object. It could take one of two paths. Well, our observation now shows us which path it took. But if you make the observation and show it took the other path, it said now that it actually did take the other path, that our observation in the present determines what happened in the past. And I know this sounds wacky and all the rest, but the point is just that time is a little bit more mysterious and squirmy and less easy to comprehend than we used to think.
And I don't remember all the details, but I sat through a fascinating talk once where they said, we can never, if we figure out how to go back in time, we can never go back past the point where they invented the time machine. And I forget exactly why that is. But
now it's starting to sound like Star Trek.
Right, right. So now, like, if we ever see somebody from the future, then we know that in this moment in time, we've invented the time machine somewhere.
Oh, brilliant.
So that's just kind of something cool to keep in mind.
I never thought of that. Ben in Rhode Island writes, do all cultures draw lines between the same stars to make the same constellations, or do they see different constellations? For example, do all cultures over time look at Orion and the Big Dipper and call them different names, or have different cultures connected the dots in different ways?
The Japanese in particular and the Chinese drew tinier patterns than the desert-dwelling Arabs and the Greeks did. We've inherited Europeans, and now we Americans have inherited essentially our Western patterns, but very different patterns were drawn in the Far East. And then on top of that, you get some really strange things, like to some cultures, it was the dark areas within the Milky Way that got put together and made into patterns rather than, so it was black on white that made the patterns that jibed with their mythologies.
Oh, cool.
Rather than our white on black patterns.
You know.
Yeah, it's really cool to think about, and I try and get in the planetarium the students to think about this. The constellations are based on your culture and what's around you, and I think of Scorpio as the great example. I have never experienced a scorpion in real life here in New York, only at a zoo or pet store or whatever.
Right.
So I would
never. They sell scorpions at pet stores?
I think so.
Good Lord. Okay.
But I would never dream up a scorpion constellation because that's not what I experience every day. It's only cultures that are a bit more south or in the desert that experience these things that then came up with those pictures in the sky. So it's all cultural and different everywhere.
Very cool.
Not to mention, since the caller mentioned Orion, that some cultures like the Babylonians did not see it as a hunter. They saw Orion as a sheep. And in fact, the famous star Betelgeuse, its original name is the shoulder of the white-belted sheep.
Ah. Oh, interesting.
The armpit of the sheep. Arguably the least attractive name that anyone's ever come up with. Sheep's armpit.
Wow. This is from Art. Where would you go tomorrow in the Capital District for the best shot to see the Northern Lights?
Somewhere north of the cities. I don't know if Bob maybe has a specific suggestion, but the Northern Lights are going to be in, as he said, the northwestern sky. So you got to be farther north of Albany and Saratoga, ideally. You know, if you can get up in the Adirondacks and have a clear, nice view of the northern sky, that's the best. Okay. I don't know. Do you have any specific locations, Bob?
Don't say Alaska, Bob.
Although I trust the National the Weather Service, I really do. What I brought here, and it's just for you guys when the show is over, I'll show it to you, that during the 2017 eclipse, all day long, the National Weather Service said, great eclipse, August 21st, 2017, and they had the full page, their website page, was devoted to a graphic showing a lunar eclipse.
Did somebody lose their job over that?
I hope so.
Mike in Rexford writes, and then we'll go back to the phones. I just checked online. Is it welder's glasses or welder's glass? Should it look like a pair of safety glasses or a flat rectangular piece of dark glass?
Flat rectangular piece.
Mm-hmm. You can't wear goggles.
Well, if you have a goggle that can fit those on, that's fine. But they're sold as rectangles that are roughly 2 inches by 4 or 5 inches.
Okay. Let's go back to our phone lines, and we go to Rensselaer. Rich.
Hi. I'd like to know that asteroid that's going to be passing between the Earth and the Moon this weekend, is that going to tend to make our days longer and the lunar months longer or shorter?
I missed that. I don't recall seeing one coming that close, but regardless, I can tell you that it shouldn't really have any effect.
Too little mass.
Yeah. And the space between us and the moon is, 30 Earth diameter, so it's a lot bigger than we perceive it to be. So it's not going to change our rotation or our day or anything like that.
Doesn't every piece of mass in the universe affect every other piece of mass?
Well, sure, it does, but the gravitational force between the Earth, which is huge, and this tiny little massive object, the forces that are involved are not going to affect the Earth very much at all.
Yeah, think of a fly hitting the windshield of a cement truck.
Right. The cement truck doesn't stop when that happens.
Yeah, no. Okay, you said the sun is losing mass at all the time, so doesn't that mean the Earth is always moving away from the sun?
Well, that's a good point, but believe it or not, 6 million tons of mass per second. That sounds like, slow down. Sounds worrisome. But the sun's actual weight, which I believe is 10 followed by 33 zeros grams, means that it's actually going to be billions of years before it makes a difference. Actually, 1.1 billion years is the current thinking that will change the sun enough to change its output and affect Earth.
All right, Rich, thank you very much. Our number here is 800-348-2551. Astronomy Today with Bob Berman at Valerie Rapson. Albany, Bill, you're on.
Hey there. I have a quick question. I used to navigate when I was in the Navy from San Diego all the way to Kenya. And when it was nice and sunny, we would do local apparent noon fixes. And so you would get your sextant and you would measure at the highest point the sun was. And that would basically be calculated back to your latitude. And so you would figure that on the winter solstice, you'd have to subtract, 23 and a third degrees from that. And that would be your latitude. If you were to do it a couple of days ago on the equinox, it would be almost exactly your latitude. But I've tried doing that at home with my son's homemade Boy Scout sextant, and it's not working. In fact, when I did it on the winter solstice, it came to 43 degrees, which is our latitude. So is my memory wrong about how you get a fix?
No, but I just do it easier. And the easiest way is doing it with Polaris, the North Star, which, as you know, the pointer stars of the, and then whatever height it is, that's your latitude, period. No corrections needed.
Right. But the reason why you would do local apparent noon fixes is it also gives you longitude, because the timing of where you are tells you how far east or west.
Then you need accurate time also.
Mm-hmm.
As you know.
Shouldn't it be your latitude and then in winter that measurement, and then you would subtract, you would add back 23 degrees. But if I did, it put us really off. I'm just wondering. was I doing something wrong with that local apparent noon calculation? Yeah, it was a long time ago when I did this.
Yes, but I have so much respect for you having ever done that with navigation. Being a longtime pilot, I can't even imagine taking my eye off the GPS and the easy stuff in the cockpit and actually taking out a sextant and doing that. So, boy, I have a lot of respect for you.
Bill, thanks for the call. This email from Jason in Amherst. My question is about novas and supernovas. So our sun will end its tenure as a red giant, then transition to a white dwarf. What property determines whether it goes nova or not as it transitions to white dwarf? And that is from Jason in Amherst.
Bob said this before, and it's mass, right? Yep. It depends. If you're 8 solar masses or larger, you have the potential to go supernova. Ideally, the bigger you are, the higher that chance is, and the more violent the explosion is going to be. The sun is just much too small, being only one solar mass by definition. It's going to release material in what we call a planetary nebula is what the end result will be there, but it's not a final collapse and all the material is released. It's like a phased transition of I'm going to toss out some material and then 1,000 years later I'm going to do it again, and it just kind of keeps releasing it into space over time. So it's a much less violent mass loss than
as Roberto Duran originally pointed out.
That's right, when he was fighting Sugar Ray Leonard.
Yeah, he said, no mas, no mas.
Oh, okay. I was like, where are we going with this?
Don't worry, Valerie. It was a fight that happened before you were born.
I think so.
This email from Charlie. I should have written earlier. A listener brought up unknown objects or similar. Some few months back, I looked up in the early night sky and saw two objects the size of Venus moving close and parallel to the other in a south direction. I know satellites don't move very fast, and they were certainly not airplanes. Airplanes emit jet sounds. These didn't, and besides, I know the difference. This is not the first time I have seen unidentified objects in the skies, though it is the first time I saw two flying parallel to the other. Humans would not be able to survive the G-force as these objects were going. Just sharing.
Well, as an old-time pilot, my first thought, of course, is the landing lights of a plane heading in your direction, and they would look parallel to each other and would be moving together. Otherwise, probably just a routine mothership.
Two helicopters. No. By the way, sound is a funny thing. Sometimes you won't hear them.
Right.
You can look up and say, oh, where's the sound? We were watching a high-flying plane the other day, and took a while. I mean, sound travels so much slower than light. This email from Paul in Montague, Massachusetts. I encourage your panelists, it's you two, listen up, to do more research on the use of auto-darkening welder's helmets for viewing the eclipse. I'm not sure what level of protection the units provide in terms of 12 to 14, etc. I'd like to be able to have it quantified. Anecdotally, I used an auto-darkening helmet to view the transit of Venus that occurred a few years ago, and it worked beautifully. It was a highlight of a lifetime of sky-watching and did not seem to cause any problems to my vision. If we knew exactly what the protection rating was, it may provide a very viable option for viewers. That's from Paul in Montague, Massachusetts.
Good idea. Why not call the company or call your welding supply store and find out exactly what the level of darkening is?
I would not risk this. As you say, Valerie, you won't feel it, and then
Right. Then years later, you'll see some effects. But I mean, I will look it up too, because the more people that view the eclipse safely, the better on my part. So,
you know, I got a letter from a reader of Astronomy Magazine a few years ago who said that one of his eyes was permanently ruined by using a telescope sweeping near the sun looking for the planet Mercury years ago, and he got too close to the sun, and the sun went into the telescope just for a moment. He quickly took his eye away, but that was enough. That moment was enough that he still has a ruined eye. So as Valerie pointed out, why take a chance?
We did this experiment back when I was at the Dudley Observatory, and we put a cow's eye up to an unfiltered telescope, and it burnt in 5 seconds. Like, it was on fire in 5 seconds.
It was on fire?
So, you know, and that's long past the point where you would have eye damage if it was just a normal eye. So
that's quite an experiment. So
it was so much fun.
So you just got the cow's eyes and you
held
it up.
And yeah, we held it up. We aimed the telescope safely first, held up the eye, took off the filter, and then 5 seconds later, it popped and you could see the smoke coming out.
Oh,
we videoed it. It's on YouTube. You can look it up.
That is crazy. All right. So, you know, one thing I noticed, and we only have 30 seconds left, the article that you sent, Valerie, on the Webb telescope capturing this Wolf-Rayet star.
Yeah.
Page 2 or 3 of that. said there's still more dust in the universe than astronomers' current dust formations theories can explain.
Mm-hmm.
We have a dust budget surplus.
Right.
And yet we talk about dark matter and things like that. There's so much we don't know.
Right. I think the mass of dark matter that we need for all those effects is so much more than we could ever imagine in the form of dust being created by stars. So you're right in that there is a lot more dust that we're just not easily able to see, but it's never going to amount to what dark matter says should be out there.
Valerie, how do people find out the goings at the SUNY Oneonta Observatory?
Yeah. Check it out on our website, the SUNY Oneonta website. We've got a planetarium show this Friday and every other Friday going forward.
And Bob, how do people find out about your tours?
I would say specialinteresttourist.com.
All right. Well, both of you, thanks very much for being here. Support comes from Nine Pin Cider Works, Albany, New York hard cider from local apples, serving gluten-free and vegan food options. Open 7 days starting at 11 a.m. ninepincider.com. At the Albany Pine Bush Preserve, presenting opportunities to engage in community science, invasive species training on March 29th to help map locations of the preserve, albanypinebush.org. Well, once again, thanks to Bob Berman and Valerie Rapson for joining us today. Thanks to Zach Malloy, our engineer. Thank you for listening, and thanks for the emails, the calls, etc. Thanks to Dr. Norman Konarkanuki, who screened our calls today. Our regular call screener was done around. Tomorrow, 2 p.m., good heavens, it's Food Friday, and it's time to chat about pies with Ellen Gray of No More Mr. Nice Pie. We'll see you tomorrow at 2.